Hello and welcome to the KO Knockout Podcast. Today, we sit down with Lauren Sulis, Vice President at Prudential Private Capital. Born and raised in a small town outside of Kansas City, Missouri, with entrepreneurial parents and a strong Greek heritage, Lauren shares her story to encourage anyone interested in finance to apply. She emphasizes that even if you come from a non-traditional background or don't fit the typical mold of the role, the finance world is shifting, and now, more than ever, not only are diverse perspectives valuable, but they're celebrated. Please enjoy.
We are here because as women in business, we don't want to walk alone on our path to success. We believe that by teaching and supporting one another, we can gain the knowledge we need and build a community where we belong. We are the Knockouts. Women who champion other women and see every obstacle as an opportunity. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Weekly Knockout. We are here with Lauren Sulis. Why don't we just kick off? Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so, I was born in a small town outside of Kansas City, Missouri. So I was not born in Greece. I'm part Greek. That's kind of a bigger piece of who I am today than it was growing up. But yeah, I grew up in my parents' business and was a pretty nerdy kid.
What kind of business did your parents have?
They have a retail jewelry store.
Very cool.
Yeah.
You're not the first person I've met that is the daughter of a family-owned jewelry retail store. That's so interesting. I'm sure that your parents work incredibly hard and were true entrepreneurs. Based on my last conversation, it's a challenging business.
It's a very challenging business, and it's definitely not what you might perceive it to be from the outside. It looks like it's a lot of fun being around a lot of beautiful, shiny, pretty things. But my parents definitely work incredibly hard. They built the business pretty much from scratch and grew through the years to be a much bigger, more established business that they are today. And they really embody sort of the American entrepreneurial spirit.
Wow. So that's incredible. And you're from a small town, which is a bit unique. Tell us about the town you grew up in.
Yeah, I think now it has about 10,000 people. When I was growing up, it was probably closer to 7,000 people, a few stoplights. We lived outside of the town, actually. So we weren't even really inside the town.
Not in downtown?
Yeah, we weren't downtown. The jewelry store was downtown. But, it's kind of a commuter community by and large, kind of a lot of farming influence and then also a lot of people who were commuting into the city. I wouldn't really call it like a suburb like of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex where I live today, which is, you go to one of the suburbs and you don't really feel like you've left Dallas necessarily because it's all kind of a big extension of one city. This was a little more rural. There's cornfields and cows and, pretty down-to-earth community.
So you grew up with an entrepreneurial family in a small town, and now you have a big fancy job in Dallas doing renewable energy investing. Walk us from point A to point, I'm sure we're at point, M now, where are we?
We're into the alphabet pretty far, okay. I think. Yeah, it's a little bit of an unlikely path. And I do like to, when we're talking with analyst candidates, I do sometimes share the background just because I think it is a little daunting to people sometimes when they're applying for a role in finance, especially if they're from a non-traditional background or they feel like they don't look exactly like, sort of their image of someone in finance, sort of the traditional stereotypical person that they might think of based on reading the Wall Street Journal or something like that. One, I think that's changing a lot. And two, I think that your background is interesting, and we all have this really diverse perspective that we come from. While I think it's probably a little unlikely my path here, I do want to point out that I think it's shifting, and the finance world, the investment world especially, is really a lot more open to diverse perspectives and diverse backgrounds, and really isn't just sort of looking for one little thing that fits neatly in a box. I diverge from your question, which is, how did I get here? I bugged my parents. I was super nerdy in school. I wanted and needed a lot more than sort of what I felt like I was getting. And I asked my parents to go to private school. I bugged them relentlessly. I researched it. I like set up a tour at all these different private schools, and, you know, eventually got accepted into and got a scholarship to a private school in Kansas City. And that really is probably the pivotal thing that changed my life in the biggest way. From there, I had friends, I was thriving. I was a little bit behind from a curriculum perspective relative to my peers, but caught up, thrived, and ended up having an opportunity to go with one of my friends to try rowing. The Kansas City Rowing Club had come to this private high school that I was going to, and they were looking for new people to join the Kansas City Rowing Club. And one of my good friends was in the meeting, and she was like, why don't you stay for this meeting? I had been in there tutoring a math student. I mean, Lindsay, I'm that nerdy. I'm staying after school tutoring other kids in math in the athletic director's classroom, and got roped into staying for an athletic meeting, right? That's this amazing. Was not my purpose for being there at all.
Hurry up so we can get back to math, guys. Come on, let's get this rowing thing out of the way.
Yeah. So one of my friends wanted to try it, and she was like, well, you'll come with me and try it, right? I was like, yes. And so I tried rowing and ended up kind of being not bad at it. And so I did that. And I ended up, we did periodic testing on the rowing team, and I got pulled a really good score on an ERG test, on a 2000 meter test. I ended up getting recruited off of that test to go to SMU. So it's a really long story and really circuitous, but kind of this just odd series of things led me to get recruited to a Division I rowing program. And I accepted, and I came to SMU to row. And from there, decided to major in finance and minored in mechanical engineering, and started straight out of undergrad working for Prudential Private Capital. So that's the really quick version of the windy path that led me here.
Rowing is a very interesting sport. I mean, it's a team sport, but it's also very much an individual mental game.
Yes.
What does your gift for rowing tell us about you, Lauren?
So I have to admit, Lindsay, like, I'm a really okay-ish rower. Like, in terms of Division I rowers, like, I'm really average. I don't look like that impressive, right? Like, I'm not extra tall. I'm tall enough. I'm not super like ripped. I'm like just kind of freakishly strong for my size, but otherwise not that impressive. I think the thing that made me okay and pretty good at rowing, or good enough to sort of be recruited and be on the team and you know, desirable positions, was I think I'm just really persistent. I don't know. I think, as you say, it's a tough sport. It's really uncomfortable. I think people get rowing machines and think that it's going to be really fun. No offense to anyone who loves it. Bless you. That's awesome. I think it's a special torture device. But being outside and being on the water and working together as a team, and certainly, you know, the fitness aspect is awesome. Like, I love endurance sports. Love running, climbing mountains, hiking, you know, all the endurance sports that are a little uncomfortable, just seem to be able to get through the uncomfortable parts of it, maybe.
Interesting. And, you know, I sort of get this tie-in that you are persistent, and you're also not afraid of doing things where you're not the best. You're not the top. I mean, some people, I have two children, one's like this, one's not, but only do things that they're amazing at and that they're destined to be the absolute, absolute best. You're willing to try things where you start out not knowing where you're going to end up, which I think it takes a very special personality, a special kind of confidence to be able to do those kind of things. So that's very cool to enjoy something where, you know, according to you, you're probably never going to go to the Olympics, but you're competing. You're there. You're playing the game. You're part of the team. I mean, I think that's great.
Lindsay, I've lost more rowing races than I've won by miles, right? Like by absolute miles. I've lost some rowing races like so badly. It's like, you can't quite tell whether you're in which race you're in. Like, are you in this one or are you in that one? But I think it's something that I've learned about myself and just generally about kind of like nothing I've cared about in my life came particularly easily. I think we have to keep being willing to fail or not do like super well, right? Like we have to keep being willing to do that because if we're not, we're probably not growing. I don't know if that makes sense.
And that thirst you have for knowledge and growth is probably more powerful than any kind of fear of losing, you know, or fear of not being the best. You just want to grow, which is so, I mean, energizing to be around. That's very cool.
Well, what's the downside if we lose, right? I mean, I think especially as adults, and there have been people who've written entire books about this, right? How we get this sense of being willing to lose kind of like knocked out of us as we grow. We become more and more risk averse. We become more and more fearful of failing. And it doesn't serve us well as adults. As kids, we're super willing to fail. Like we fall off the monkey bars. We try to do a difficult math problem and we fail repeatedly until we get it right. And then there's this some point where we kind of are told that we can't fail, that we shouldn't fail. And we begin to believe it, I think. Maybe I missed that one. I don't know.
Well, it ties in a little bit to your transition to your current career. I mean, when you started out at Prudential, you were more on the oil and gas side of the business. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I started in our oil and gas and general corporate finance team, doing, you know, sort of general corporate financing. So, you know, kind of like your water well drillers, your service businesses, your C-stores, greeting cards, you know, kind of typical down the fairway companies, and then also doing upstream and midstream oil and gas. So it was, do things that way anymore. We have a dedicated corporate finance team in Dallas, and then we have a dedicated oil and gas or energy practice now in Dallas. But that was kind of what the team was like when I first started at Prudential. And it was, I started the analyst program, and it's sort of a 3 years plus or minus program, after which you're generally expected to kind of go do something else. Most people kind of go to grad school or, figure out that they want to be a nurse because finance isn't for them, or you know, something, you know, tangential or similar, but typically it's a 3-year program. I got to the end of my third year. I was asked to stay for a fourth and I liked it. It was certainly interesting. I felt like I had learned a lot, but I had a new associate on my team who was sort of in between me and my team leader. And I was kind of teaching him a lot of how to do everything. And it was good. Certainly, you know, a great way to learn is to teach. But I felt like my own growth had stagnated as a result. And I wanted a new challenge. And so I was pretty candid with my managing director and, you know, appreciative for the opportunity to stay, but said, you know, I really think that I probably need to go find a new challenge. And he was really supportive about that, actually. And he initially was kind of let me look around a little bit. And he said, you know, this was 2009 as well, by the way.
I remember that.
Yeah, you remember that? Yeah, 2009. Kind of an interesting point in time in our country and the world.
You were just confidently like, oh, I'll find another job, no big deal. I think most of us were like, wow, I'm gonna hunker down wherever I am if I employed.
Yeah, I'm not sure what compelled me to have that level of confidence. And I did find other opportunities, but they weren't maybe the right fit for me, or I didn't feel like they were a great fit. And I had a pretty open dialogue with my managing director, and he was like, you know, those are fine, but why don't you just stay for fourth year and move to our power group? You know, they need a new analyst. They could really use the help. You know all of our systems already. It would be a challenge for you. Would you consider doing that? And I hadn't really thought about that. When I first applied to Prudential, and they had a role in the power group, and I was like, utilities, that sounds really boring. Why would I want to do that? And I really just didn't have a great understanding of what we do in our power practice. And so with the benefit of time and really some additional exposure, I realized that utilities are just a small piece of what we do, and certainly they can be interesting as well. But our power practice is financing really anything that makes or moves power. And the bulk of that portfolio is project finance, where we're financing, you know, the construction and operation really of one or a few projects held in a special purpose entity. And it's a really highly structured transaction, really reliant on a lot of modeling and engineering work. And there's a lot of legal documentation around it. And I didn't appreciate that, you know, previously. I didn't understand it.
So was joining the power group the challenge that you were looking for? Did it give you that stimulus that you needed to stay interested? And at what cost? You know, did you have to kind of learn something from the beginning? How did that impact your career trajectory, having to kind of go back to, I wouldn't say square one, but a couple of steps?
Yeah, so I wasn't really starting from scratch, but at the same time, I didn't really know much of anything about power. I'd minored in mechanical engineering, so I was somewhat familiar with the vocabulary and some of the math, but I really didn't have the in-depth knowledge that other analysts on the team had at that point. My peers who started at the same time as analysts, you know, they really had a huge leg up, and it was a lean team. So there wasn't really necessarily a formal training program around, you know, power finance. You know, our training at Prudential Private Capital at that time, which I want to give the disclaimer that we're a lot better at this now than we were when I joined, but we were a much smaller team when I joined. And we, you know, everybody was kind of all hands on deck and contributing in every way that they could. So I had to really figure a lot of stuff out on my own. And I had to kind of get myself up to speed and find a way to be functional. I wasn't familiar with power project modeling. I wasn't familiar with the legal documentation. I wasn't familiar with some of the terminology. And so everything took me twice as long as it would take another analyst from my level. I was, you know, looking up every fourth word. I was double checking my math. I was, you know, really trying to sort through how to do some of these things. Certainly I had some resources and could ask questions of some people, but you know, they were in the middle of their own tasks, trying to get things done. So I really had to just kind of put in the time. You know, I was nights and weekends in the office, often trying to keep on pace with my deliverables, and trying to stay on task with deadlines, because it just took me a really long time to do everything when you're teaching yourself, you know, what a gearbox is and how it works on a turbine, and, you know, oh, they had a main bearing failure. Well, what's that? Is that a big thing or is that not a big thing? I definitely encountered a few challenges along the way, I'd say.
We just had a life science event, and I think that for me is like the ultimate, I don't know how they do what they do, because the technical knowledge there is so complex that to be an investor, you almost also have to be a scientist. But But I wonder in the power industry, I mean, we do events in the power sector, and it's always a huge challenge for our team. And we're just trying to pick interesting topics and speakers. Like, I can't imagine trying to underwrite a project with technical elements. I mean, it really must be like you almost have to put your engineering skills to work and think like an engineer. Or I mean, is that part of the challenge? And do you use your engineering background at all in that work?
A little bit. I would say that, you know, I mean, I'm minored in mechanical engineering, so I know just enough to be a lot dangerous. But I think the best thing that I took from that is to figure out what you don't know. If I took nothing else from engineering classes, that's probably the most valuable. You've got to figure out what you don't know. What's missing? What are they not telling you? What question am I not asking that I should be asking? You know, we have a lot of professional help. So the good thing is that, you know, I'm not expected to be an engineer while I'm underwriting a power transaction. We have, you know, outside consultants who are engineers, and we get to pick their brain and we get to read their opinions and see their technical analysis of the different aspects of a power project. So we have a lot of help. I don't want it to sound like, you know, doing some sort of Herculean task, but at the same time, when you're trying to figure out what is and is not a relevant risk, and what is and is not particularly impactful, you have to have some level of understanding of how power plants work. You know, all the different variables involved from the, you know, sort of beginning of construction until the operational phase. And then once you're in operations, what are the major areas of risk and concern? And without kind of that functional working knowledge, it's certainly more challenging. And a lot of that comes from experience, and there's really not a lot of substitute for experience and seeing a lot of transactions and working on a lot of transactions through their life.
What's next? I mean, you've called yourself a nerd, so hopefully I'm not insulting you.
No.
But, you know, what are you nerding out about? What are you excited about as you look forward? What's the next big challenge for you?
Wow, that's a great question. Maybe one that I don't even know the answer to yet, but I think the great thing about, certainly professionally within the realm of power, it's constantly evolving. And I think that's one of the best things about this role and why it's been a good fit for me and why I've stayed and why they've kind of kept me engaged and how I've managed to find really a real reason to keep doing it every day, to keep getting up and doing it. There's always something else to learn in power. And the regulatory environment is shifting. Consumer preferences are shifting. Certainly, what we know about the environment and climate change is evolving and how we're reacting to that from a both a consumer preference perspective and from a legislative perspective. And so that's, you know, driving a lot of evolution within the industry. And, you know, what was a normal way of looking at things when I started in the industry, you know, has shifted. The markets have shifted. Really everything is different. And so I think to be a good power investor, you have to be a good student. You have to be willing to learn, and you have to be willing to keep growing and evolving with the industry, because it is changing quite a lot.
It really is, I think, the most fascinating area. So much innovation, the awakening of the consumer. I always try to get my team jazzed about working in the power sector, but you know, I think people are really starting to pay attention to where their energy comes from and, you know, what are the complexities with building out the infrastructure. So I think you're just in the great seat for the next, you know, decade, maybe two or three decades. No shortage of interesting things are going to happen.
No shortage of interesting things. And, you know, I think, you know, every year as the legislative landscape changes and as the climate shifts, even we have new challenges that are thrown at us. You know, the last 2 years, it's been the insurance space. A lot of solar projects have a difficult time getting coverage for some of the NatCat perils, convective storm, hail, named Windstorm, Wildfire, those perils are very difficult to insure for a lot of solar projects and other power projects as well. But you know, if you're a solar project in Texas, it's almost impossible to get hail coverage, for instance. Or if you do get hail coverage, it's significantly sublimited, where you know you're only covered for a portion of your replacement cost of the project, and that's disruptive. And so, from the investor perspective, we're constantly trying to solve around that risk, because it's certainly not a risk that was part of the landscape when we executed transactions 10 years ago, for instance. So it's definitely constant evolution, and we're trying to be, you know, creative and nimble as we encounter all of the things that are coming our way.
What would be your dream project that comes across your desk in 2022? Like, you'd like to see more of fill in the blank.
You know, that's difficult to say, because I would say our dream project as an underwriter, you want a clean project, right? You want a well-sided, you know, project with a bus bar PPA and reliable panel supplier. It's a solar project. You know, you want all the boxes checked, but you know, what we want in terms of providing, you know, a good sort of risk reward balance, you know, that's, if that project exists, the pricing for that is very thin. There's a lot of competition for it. And so I think, you know, more than having a wish list, my sense is that, you know, we want to make sure that we're able to find projects that need financing, one, and trying to be creative about, you know, the challenges that are out there. You know, busbar PPA is hard to come by, right? And so solving the problem around, you know, how do we make this stream of cash flow that's coming off of this project financeable? What kind of financing solution can we put in place for this? I think is more the question than, you know, kind of what do I want? You know, tax subsidies are challenging, for instance. It's a double-edged sword. Do I want sort of PTCs to continue? Do I want the tax incentives to continue so that there's more build out of renewables? Well, absolutely. As somebody who cares passionately about the environment, I want renewables to continue to be built, and the incredible expense side or the cost gains that have occurred as a result of increased penetration of renewables has been beneficial to the whole market, right? As the cost curve has come down through increased build out, that's beneficial for everybody. The flip side of that is that those transactions are very difficult to finance. Finding tax equity and financing with tax equity or alongside or on top of tax equity, it's a much more complicated structure. Yeah. So, you know, I think if you ask a lot of traditional lenders what they want, you know, they don't want to see a tax subsidized situation, just because it makes the capital structure a lot harder. Finding tax equity for a developer is, in some instances, very challenging. You know, it's the coveted piece of the capital structure.
I feel like that's another podcast for another day.
Yes.
I find tax equity something I nod, but I don't really understand how it all works. So you'll have to come back and explain that to us. Well, this has been really fun, Lauren. I mean, you are a delight to talk to, and I like the way you see the world. You know, do you have a mantra that guides you that you could share as we close out today?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've heard pieces of it already. You know, when we were preparing for this, I think I told you the nerdy backstory of this, and it's I think it's kind of been my mantra for most of my life, whether I knew it or not. And it's Hannibal, the Carthaginian general, who, by the way, led elephants across the Alps as he was attempting to invade Rome. The Second Punic Wars.
Wow.
But anyway, his quote is either find a way or make one. So I think that's been kind of one of the leading thoughts that stays with me when I encounter new challenges. And certainly every day we find them. Just got to find a way through or make one up.
Find a way or make one. I love it. All right, Lauren. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been really fun. We would love to see more of you, and I wish you all the best with your investing in 2022.
Thanks, Lindsay. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care. Thanks everyone for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining this conversation. Lauren's persistence to succeed, thirst for knowledge and growth, and ability to try new things has carried into every new challenge she's overcome. Throughout her career and life, she has stayed true to her mantra, either find a way or make one. Thanks for listening.